This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rassland, today we have the return of, she is a producer here at BFM, and she is Julian Yap.
Hello.
Hello, and we have the return of, he's been away, he's been in Australia, actually, for 3 months.
Yes, I have.
Bonza, mate. And he was once upon a time the youngest creative director in Kuala Lumpur in advertising.
Well, keeps reminding me of this bad past of mine.
Not bad past. He is Vernon Adrian Among.
Thank you for having me back.
Great to have you back. And our three topics this week will be movie awards. Are they worth anything? Mm-hmm. Number two is indigeneity. Mm-hmm. And number three is we are not yet ready and the Balai Cine fiasco. Mm. So, Julian, awards.
Sure. I think in true fashion with the Oscars that just happened this Monday, it was kind of really nice to see, of course, Parasite winning for Best Film, Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, and it didn't get too many awards in terms of acting, but it did. It's been recognized completely all over the world as this force in cinema and of kind of reminding people that Korean cinema and foreign film cinema is something that you should be paying attention to and something that you should reckon with. And it's kind of it being the first Korean film or first foreign language film to win the Best Picture mm-hmm. at the Oscars in 92 years, it feels very, very late, but also very nice, because one of the very nice things that have come out of this this week that I've seen quite a bit online is that a lot of people are looking for more Korean films to watch, and they want to expand their library and want to learn more about, well, in very, very heavy air quotes, Korean film, because I mean that's also a very catch-all term, right? Like saying watching Parasite means you want to learn more about Korean film. That's also like if you want to watch more American films, you should watch, I don't know.
If you watch
Bohemian Rhapsody, like that's not
Godfather Part 2, you should watch Caddyshack.
Yeah. Like it's not it feels a little bit vague, but also I think it's a nice way to see where things are going in terms of how what people want to learn and want to watch, because at the same time a lot of TV programming, traditional TV programming mm-hmm. like the BBC, HBO, they're programming Bong Joon-ho's older films like Mother, Memories of Murder, The Host, Okja. I think Snowpiercer and Okja, which are both on Netflix, they're trending right now because everyone wants to go back and watch all of his films. Mm. So I was reminded of how when I was a kid, I used to watch the Academy Awards every single year. It was a mm-hmm. big deal to me, not because I knew anything about movies, but just because I wanted to learn about what these films would be, even though I hadn't seen any of them. A lot of them were too adult for me to watch. I didn't have access to them as well, so being here in Malaysia, but it was just something that I always looked forward to. Maybe it started out with like the glitz and glam of like the award shows, but it was always something really appealing to me. So I like the idea of that, even though I know that the awards might not hold any sort of weight anymore.
So, you just finished with that, but I was going to ask, so the Oscars have always paid off for you? They've always been a good doorway into something, or are they kind of like, you know,
I don't know
not
if
they, a big deal?
I don't know if good is the right term. Maybe like a useful tool, because a lot of the time a lot of these are very America focused, some years more British focused, it does feel like it. Even though the award show makes no sense to have anymore, viewership is down, it costs near $50 million to put on, it kind of makes no sense to celebrate these people in a lot of films that a lot of people can't access anymore. But it's also still very nice to me where I don't care about it the entire year and I say that, oh, it doesn't matter at all. But then the day of, I check and I cannot put my phone down because I'm checking who
really?
The winners
oh
are.
My
here.
God. Like,
I cried in the office the other day because Parasite won.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Vernon?
Well,
Oscars?
Oscars, yeah. Well, I was, number one, watching it this time around, I went, oh my God, the Oscars is not so white. I mean, they obviously went to great pains to make sure that it was not white. And that was really interesting to see. Mm-hmm. Number two, the whole idea that it is a springboard to, a different culture, a mm-hmm. different lifestyle, different ways of practicing cinema. I agree completely. I mean, I've always used it as a reference point to see which kinds of to search out especially the documentaries segment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because I love documentaries, and the Oscars for the documentaries is one list that I look to look for the, you know, best documentaries mm-hmm. that have come out that year. So yes, and we must remember that award shows are kind of like a PR initiative for the industry. And for Bong Joon-ho this year, it was a long time in the working. I mean, I read this article about Mickey Lee, the mogul behind the Korean entertainment industry, and what she had to do or what she went through in terms of a history to get Korean film and Bong Joon-ho to this place and this time. It took her several decades, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Koreans have really played the long game.
Yes.
And they had immense patience, but dedication to a single vision to bring Korean cinema to the world. Mm-hmm. I've never really been. The Oscars have. I not really.
About like the Tonys or the Grammys? Like, does a Grammy nominee or a Grammy winning album
never.
Does that matter?
Not
for you.
Not
it's the Booker Prize, right?
Ooh, the Pulitzer, maybe.
The Wolfson History Prize.
Okay. Ah,
no, I. You know, I mean, sure. If I'm, you mentioned, if I'm in a bookshop, then and if it does win one of the prizes, then maybe. But that prize has to fit the bill. See, the Oscars are kind of like middle brow, mm-hmm. right? They're not, you know, Ingmar Bergman never won an Oscar.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to be middle brow, but, you know.
No, nothing wrong with middle brow. But, like, if I'm in the mood for middle brow, then it's like, well, did the Oscars...
Yes, Your Majesty.
No, but even then, great films and great filmmakers have been passed over consistently.
Yes, of course. There is that whole.
I mean, like Spielberg. Spielberg really.
I mean, like even with Parasite winning. I mean, sometimes I think, yeah, it's part of the strategy of making Oscars not so white. You know.
Yeah.
So who's to say whether you know they really really won on merit? But when you look at the history of it, I mean, like they won the Grand Palme d'Or.
Palme d'Or, yeah.
Right. And they had an 8-minute standing ovation. And I think it's seriously really deserved because I saw the movie and I was so blown away.
Yeah. I haven't seen it.
And don't read anything or do any interviews about it. Just go cold into watching the movie.
That is the best way.
Yeah, because that's what everybody's saying. That's what everybody is saying about this movie. And I did that. I decided, okay, I'm going to follow the advice. And I'm so glad that that's what I did.
Yeah, because also with Bong Joon-ho, I mean, he's being rewarded for his body of work.
Yep.
Correct, yeah.
And he is, in my mind, he's just the best film director in the world at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Detail.
Detail, yeah. I mean, I think that if there is an equivalent in America, be, say, David Fincher. Mm. It's kind of there's a Fincher-esque quality.
Yeah.
But his work then goes again into another direction. And American cinema around the world, has so much to learn from how Koreans are making their movies. In details, absolutely visual details, which are just ignored in American cinema. But so much of the story.
No, because they're churning it out, I guess. I mean, when was Bong Joon-ho's last movie before Parasite?
2017, 2016?
Oh, he's making every.
So what is it?
He's doing every 2 years.
Yeah,
it's a sweatshop in Korea.
Every 2 years. Well, we must move on, though. But so you're saying, Julian, that this awards year season has been good.
This year would have sucked if Parasite hadn't been there. And I'm glad that the Oscars kind of still exists as the kind of bridge between the low and the high. And it can be the middle brow for
everyone. Yeah.
I like that.
Especially because if let's say, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah.
If that had won, a movie about Hollywood by Hollywood.
Yeah.
Probably
I would not have cared.
Would have not really been the thing. Okay. So we're going to move on, though, to topic number two and a word which I don't use enough. but it's a great word. Indigeneity, Vernon.
Yes, indigeneity. As Mr. Cam Raslan mentioned, I've just come back from a holiday in Australia, and I was there for quite a long time. I maxed out my tourist visa and thought I'd explore the country. And one thing that I came to mind was their acknowledgement of indigeneity, Australian indigeneity. Indigenous people of Australia, all their public events, official events, begin with an acknowledgement of country where they acknowledge the traditional land owners of where the event is held. The name of the tribe is mentioned and they acknowledge and pay respects to the elders, past, present, and forthcoming. And this is like, you know, Tuan Tuan dan Puan Puan. And sometimes we have the Doa. Well, in Australia, it's the Indigenous people. And it made me think about how amazing the Australian attitude to indigeneity has become, that it's such a strong part of everyday, you know, practice, that you are being reminded that you're just coming in on a time when other people have come before you, and you need to pay respects to these people and to their practice and to their traditions. And I think it's a really, really, really nice thing to be doing, number one. Number two, it also made me think about indigeneity here in Malaysia and how it's so contested. We have Indigenous people, and also we have the Parti Bersatu, Parti Pribumi Bersatu, which is the part of the ruling coalition. And there is a kind of like a claimed indigeneity in their name,
true,
right? So then it puts into question Orang Aslis and, you know, the Orang Asal and Orang Asli, what exactly, how does it all kind of like work out in the scheme of things? So this whole idea of like indigeneity came to mind when these two thoughts kind of like collided. And I went and dug up the definition, the scholastic definition, and it said basically indigeneity or Indigenous people are people who are living in a particular area before colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So then it made me think about here in Malaysia, good God, colonialism has gone on for eons and eons, long before the Portuguese even, perhaps, you know, as foreign people, pendatangs, the first pendatangs came. Who were the first pendatangs? And how did that affect the Indigenous people? And what happened as time moved on and other colonialists came? And it made me think about a conversation that I was having with my cousin, who's married to a Welshman in Australia. And he was saying how the Celtic language was outlawed at one point in time by the English, who were seen as the pendatang. So, yeah, it made me think about all these things.
Wow, you're just like overturning my whole concepts of nationhood, Vernon.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And this is very interesting too, this idea of nation. I mean, like, apparently, because I was there during Australia Day, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And Aboriginal or Indigenous people of Australia are referred to as First Nations people. And actually to refer to them as First Australians is actually not politically correct.
Okay, Vernon, I gotta ask you. I am not a person. I'm not a Malaysian who is particularly enthralled by things Australian. I am very suspicious, actually, of things Australian. There is a certain nativism and a casual racism that I found in Australia, which is, I find quite, you know, it's just like, oh, it's like being back in the 1950s. How jolly!
Which part of Australia?
Anywhere, but. I would ask, though, when these ceremonies you're talking about, where it's...
No, just a mention.
It's mentioned, okay. And but the actual piece of land upon which it is being mentioned,
mm-hmm.
is it actually owned by an Aboriginal group?
The phrase is the traditional landowners of this place. Where
who
we
once
at.
Upon yeah. a time owned it, but no longer do.
Correct, you could say. Yeah.
So...
Well, you know,
it's actually it's a celebration. It could be seen as a celebration of, well, it used to belong to somebody else, but now it doesn't. They've been kicked off and now we're here.
Well, celebration is a cynical way to say
well, it. Well, I am being cynical, perhaps, but I mean, if the, it's all well and good to congratulate yourself
mm-hmm.
on your magnificent 21st century wokeness, but if the people that you're being respectful toward actually no longer exist... on that piece of land because they've been dispossessed. I don't really see what the I don't see what's so cool about that.
But who created that problem in the first place?
Well, then you would be when I say you, I mean
yep.
present day Australians
right.
would be distancing themselves from this colonial period, right? Which would be all the bad things happened during the British time, the colonial period, but we have now evolved. Well, we're different from that, but you've got to own up to the fact that you're part of that continuum, or rather, Australians need to.
Okay. Which
so, but if people have been dispossessed in that journey, and they're not being repossessed, if that's the right word.
Oh, I think they are. I mean, there was a court case where a certain certain tribe in the southwest of Australia, or was it, maybe up north of Perth, was given land ownership of a particular kind.
And that's good.
So there was, yeah, so there was reconciliation.
And Ayers Rock, now called Uluru. Uluru. Yeah. And people are no longer allowed to walk on it.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
But, you know, nothing speaks louder than money. I mean, if your community actually has a stake in a piece of land.
Well, it's coming to that, so give them time.
I don't think it's ever going to happen that, you know, Sydney Harbour views are going to be handed over to the original Aboriginal.
Well, actually, I don't want to trumpet Australia's kind of like initiatives in acknowledging their indigenous people, but I think it's worth, you know, it's commendable.
Yeah, yeah.
And it does set up an example for the rest of the world. I don't think any other country has gone to such great pains as they have to remind their own people of every color.
Canadians might have something to say to you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're absolutely correct. Yeah, well, because I discovered a new kind of indigenous people in Canada while I was doing some research on this topic, okay. And they call Mestis.
Okay.
And they're kind of like my kind of people. Basically, it's the indigenous with the colonials.
All right, right.
You know, the offsprings, the miscegenation that took place.
For me, it's not something I really think about too often because I find it very difficult to process the notion of indigeneity. Because who came here first? Who has rights? Who do we acknowledge? It just becomes kind of scary because we're talking about humans, but then there's also an entire animal world. Mm-hmm. That we've
absolutely. I mean,
obliterated.
Going back to Oscar's Joaquin Phoenix's speech about mm-hmm. you know being
respecting the earth and the environment.
Yeah,
yeah.
So we, you know, consistently were writers' might, crushing whatever came before, putting our own stamp, whoever we may be, and it's just chilling all around.
Chilling.
Yeah. Because of the horrors, the absolute horrors of what were committed in terms of slavery, etc., here on the peninsula of Asia, but also in Australia.
Mm.
Absolutely horrifying.
Yeah. And so it's acknowledging it and remembering it and memorializing it in a way that, you know, the Jewish Holocaust has been memorialized talked about so that we don't repeat these things.
Yeah. Okay. Well, never forget.
Yeah.
But we must move on. We are really getting through things today. And in a moment, we're going to be asking a question about Malaysia. Not even asking a question, making the statement. We're not ready yet. Here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Julian Yap, and Vernon Adrian Among. And now, topic number three is We Are Not Yet Ready, and Balai Sini. I will start with, Jo Kukutas, with her Instant Cafe, her most recent show. She had the crowd chanting. She put forward in the character of the deputy minister, and who is it?
YB.
YB. He's like an old school Barisan National politician, and he had the crowd chanting, saying the thing with this country is that we're never ready. Mm-hmm. We are not yet ready. You name anything, democracy, and then we're not yet ready. Mm-hmm. Freedom of speech, we're not yet ready. indigenous rights, we're not yet ready. Mm-hmm. You name it. And a film industry, we're not yet ready. And recently, the National Art Gallery, I was reminded of this because there was about to be an art show, and it was all set up, it was all ready to go. But then the artist had to remove, but four of the works by the artist was a solo work.
Was removed by the ballet.
By the gallery. Yeah. One of the board members had disagreed with the artwork and had it removed. It hadn't even come from the public.
Yep.
It was presupposing what the public reaction would be and was saying, essentially, we are not yet ready. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to be putting words into people's mouths. I don't think that anybody actually came out and said, we're not yet ready. But I think that's kind of the implicit argument that the artwork was too challenging. From what the photographs I've seen, one of them, for instance, had these big kind of life-size plaster cast pigs walking around. We're not yet ready. and also some of the artwork was of Anwar Ibrahim.
Yep.
Who is a member of parliament now. I don't know what the artwork looked like, but it was of him. And but then he, as of, well, at the time of recording just yesterday, the deputy minister for tourism, arts, volleyball, and all the other things that are thrown into that department came out and said, no, it must go up so that the artwork can remain.
Yep.
And I found that was like, well, that's a first.
Yeah, Malaysia Baru.
Funny, you've been away too long. We don't say that anymore. But if, you know, for a brief moment, I did kind of like think of saying that. Because the government has traditionally, in its various forms, been either very much advocating the we are not yet ready line, or stayed silent so that other forces can contest the ground.
Yeah.
And and I'd like to ask you too, what do you think of this moment and moments like it in terms of censorship? But my feeling is that there's a lot of 21st century going on out there. And I think that whoever you may be in this country, whether you like it or not, it's probably a good idea to kind of be come face to face with it once in a while and ask yourself, do you like it or not? I mean, you can make a decision after that. But to not cancel the 21st century, that would just be ludicrous in my mind. I mean, what do you guys think?
Oh, carry on. You first.
I think this comes up a lot in terms of, especially in Malaysia, growing up with a lot of films not coming into the country, having a lot of TV shows being censored. I got to watch the latest adaptation, Greta Gerwig's adaptation of Little Women last night. And in that, there's a scene where it builds up this very beautiful, very romantic point, and there's a really quick cut, and the entire audience just goes in a little uproar because you're kind of robbed of that little thing, which is a kiss, really.
They're still cutting kisses.
They're still cutting kisses.
Oh,
and last year we did see Hustlers being brought into the country, being pulled by censors right up till the day of screening. So it's not something that stopped. We also had the Netflix controversy of people saying that Netflix should be censored. We should have a more acceptable version of Netflix that allows people to be in a safe place where they can watch things that aren't things that they typically agree with, which is, I get that. But also a lot of this art, we're talking about art right here. A lot of this is, you know, it's voluntary. It's something that you consume and you choose to consume. Yeah. It's not something that... But,
and also with Netflix, you choose to spend 48 bucks a month to consume.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? It's all about resiliency to kind of discomfort and disruption to your own sense of values.
Yeah.
And I think this thing about we are not ready is said by people who don't want change, who are actually very comfortable and set in the status quo.
Yeah.
And this is what will hold back innovation and creativity in Malaysia. And somebody had put up a tweet yesterday. Malaysia says, when are we going to have an Oscar winner like Parasite? And the Malaysian government says, we are not ready. And the thing is, the status quo is disrupted by innovation and creativity. And this is what scares people. And that is why, I guess, you know, dictators and tyrants usually go for artists and people who express themselves freely.
Yeah, young people. Yeah. I mean, there are two targets invariably. There are women and young people by dictatorships. But, you know, Vernon, you and I, we're members of a passing generation.
Indeed.
No, because I think a lot of things are often mistaken for, we forget demographic change. And, you know, new people come up and take on positions of power. And you're saying that people, Vernon, are afraid of change. They're afraid of losing power.
Yeah.
And as you get older, you lose power. So you're going to lash out at the young people who might be exhibiting, I don't know, points of view which seem radically different. But maybe there is an argument to be said that we can and should actually stop change, or at least guard people from the frightening images of change, that we can soften the blow.
The few months ago when I was on the show with you, Cam, you brought up cancel culture and how what that entails, what that means for the people who are involved and how people might see them. But I think what remains the most important part of cancel culture today is still making sure you prioritize the people who have been hurt and are potentially going to be hurt by any sort of action or any sort of statement that you want to make in your art or in anything. But I think softening that blow is to make sure that people are, as few people are as hurt as possible, and you're recognizing that they have been hurt.
Okay. Which comes back to what Venom was talking about earlier with the indigeneity and the people who have been hurt in the past.
I think it's really important to be mindful of the power you wield, you know, and always realizing that everybody exists with privileges, everybody. And how are we going to wield those privileges and that entitlement? Mm-hmm. And how are you going to work it against the situations that you come up against? How are you going to use it? And that is where mindfulness and compassion comes into play. I mean, they seem like new age terms, you know, that yoga enthusiasts would like to
use. That we're trying
use.
To teach in our schools, in moral lessons.
But I guess that's so necessary nowadays. As the world moves faster and faster.
Well, I'm always aware of the power that I wield. Mm-hmm. And but I want to wrap this one up. But
underarm deodorant will help.
But I want to ask one final question to finish off. Is that I think though ultimately we all do, whether we would admit to it or not, we do think that there is a line in the sand. Mm-hmm. There are areas that we shouldn't. Expose, we shouldn't perhaps examine, we shouldn't think about.
No, but we should also be more resilient to any kinds of disagreements or, you know, disruptions that we face. And I think it's really important for us to be able to take a step back. And if we're going to respond with respect, even when you don't agree with it. Mm. So like that person in the Balai who was appalled by what Ahmad Fuad Osman had done. Why did he not call up Ahmad Fuad Osman to say, can I understand the context behind your work? Because it's really kind of like bothering me.
Yes, apparently that conversation was not had. I'm going to finish then with one quick story, which is Marcel Deschamps, back in 1917, an artist. He, a French fella, he did a piece of work, which was an installation, which was an unheard of thing in those days, which was a urinal, urinal. Yep. He called it Fountain. It was just placed on a pedestal. And it was taken away by the exhibition holders, the curators. But it is now celebrated as being one of the...
Turning points.
Mm-hmm. A really important moment in
modern art.
Modern art. So if your work is banned, you're in good company. Because now that piece of work, urinal, I mean...
Yes, it is.
On the market.
Oh, that banana, you know.
Taped to the wall, $15,000.
What was it called again? Does anybody remember?
Yeah. Anyway, so if you have been banned, perhaps you, well, in 100 years' time, you could be rich.
And silver lining.
Yes. It's always a silver lining on a bit of culture. And so we move on, though, now to the last part of the show, recommendations. We recommend something that we think might be of interest. And Julian goes first.
Okay, so I guess riding on the Oscar wave, a film that I don't think was particularly ignored or forgotten, but I think it's still worth checking out because it's one of my favorite films I've seen over the last 2 weeks. I can't stop thinking about it. I've seen it 3 times by now, which is Uncut Gems. It's by the Safdie brothers, John and Benny Safdie. It's a film about a jeweler in the New York City Diamond District and how this man gets it. Played by Adam Sandler, an incredible performance by Adam Sandler.
I just can't abide the guy.
Ooh, Cam, you'll love him.
Really?
You love to hate him. This jeweler, he gets his hands on an uncut gem from Ethiopia. It's got, you know, the shady
going on
behind. Oh yeah, definitely not. And how that changes hands between people and the journey that he goes through and how he's hurt by what he loses and what he gains through it. It is an unrelentless 2-hour ride of stress and incredulity of just what kind of decision will he make? And it's I think exactly the kind of performance that Adam Sandler should be doing right now, because this can only be done by someone who's had the career that he's had and been hated and loved as much as he's had, as he's been. And Oh, I love it so much. It's full of great performances. Okay.
All right. Yeah. I will check it out then, because I've sort of been tempted, but I am so repulsed by Adam Sandler.
I think that's the point. You go in with this repulsion and they use it against you to love this guy, Howard Ratner. It's on Netflix now. All right. And it's worth binging. I've seen it 3 times. I love it so much.
Wow. Wow. What's it called again?
Uncut Gems.
Uncut Gems. Okay, cool. All right. And then Vernon, what you got?
Okay, well, there was this book that I discovered while going through the bookstores in Australia, and it's called Dark Emu. And it's written by Bruce Pascoe, who is an Indigenous Australian. And Dark Emu is basically his research done on proving to the rest of his compatriots that Australian Aboriginal culture, lifestyle traditions, way back when, was a lot more advanced than what we give them credit for.
Oh, yeah.
That they actually had civilization. Well, I should not use the word civilization.
No,
but they had communities that worked together, like agricultural communities, and built dams, and was actually much more advanced than we realized.
They managed the land on vast scales.
Yeah.
And what a lot of the landscapes that people look at now in Australia and say, oh, this is traditional, have not necessarily understanding that it had been worked to make it look like this.
Absolutely. And the book is called Dark Emu, and it's by Bruce Pascoe. And while I was there, a controversy erupted because his claim to indigeneity was actually challenged by other Aboriginal Australians. And that was quite an interesting, fascinating look at how identity is carved out in today's, landscape.
Cool. The book, by the way, is nonfiction.
It's nonfiction, It's based on research, and it's got pictures, And
is he a historian? Is he
He's a he's a very well-known writer, historian, anthropologist, activist. Mm-hmm. And I was going to say that the book Dark Emu was released several years ago, and they've even got a children's version.
Ooh.
Yeah. I mean, so the tipping of the hat to indigeneity in Australia is pretty advanced in that, they even promote it to young people.
Cool. Dark Emu by
Bruce Pascoe.
I'm going to check that one
P-A-S-C-O-E.
out. P-A-S-C-O-E. Wow, cool. Yep. Okay, so my recommendation is, following on from the Oscar win, a lot have been said about Bong Joon-ho, and also I noticed a lot of people on Twitter putting their lists of favorite Korean movies, Korean movies. I've never watched a North Korean movie. I would love to.
How would you get your hands on
it? I don't know, but I would love to watch a North Korean movie. But there's one movie that I've watched which I have not seen getting enough love, and I think it's a fantastic film. It is grim as hell. And it's called, in English, it's called The Yellow Sea. Mm-hmm. And it is, I'm going to have to look this one up. It's directed by Hong Jin-na, who also directed another fabulous film called The Chaser.
Mm-hmm.
Two really great films. This particular one is starring, one of the things that you mentioned, Julian, is the acting. The acting in Korean movies are magnificent. I don't know, though, if their acting style actually can translate into other cultures. I don't know if it would work in Hollywood. I'd be interested to see. But Jung Woo-ha is a really fine actor. Handsome fella in a very strange kind of way. But the movie Yellow Sea, as I say, it's grim.
Why is it?
Well, it involves a man who comes from China, but ethnic Korean, just across from the North Korean border.
Yeah.
And that community lives in a lot of poverty. And he, because all else has failed, and in order to pay off his debts, agrees to be sent down to South Korea to murder somebody. And
what is it called again? The movie?
The Yellow Sea.
The Yellow Sea.
A light watch.
A light watch. So there he is, not knowing anybody in Korea. Well, actually, no, I think he's got an ex-wife. And it's just magnificent. It does suffer from one aspect of Korean cinema, which I think needs to be pointed out, which is that far too many Korean films, great as they are, have absolutely no female characters whatsoever. And and if they do turn up, they're often just prostitutes or the victim at the beginning. And The Chaser is an example of that. But at the same time, you just got to be impressed by the skill of the filmmaking. It's just awesome. And so my recommendation is to go check out Yellow Sea. I think it's about 10 years old now, actually.
Okay, cool. Very
good. Okay, lovely.
So that brings us to the end of this week's show.
Oh, no.
Uh-huh. And so only remains for me now to thank Julian Yap.
Thank you so much.
Great to have you here. And also, good day. And welcome back, mate. To
thank you.
To
yes, Vernon gets my name.
Adrian Among. No, I'm trying to think how Australians might say. How do they call it? You know, you got
I don't know. My uni mates used to call me Voinen.
Yeah, okay, Voinen. That sounds a bit kind of New York kind of thing.
Yeah, it does a bit. Yeah.
Anyway, welcome back. And
thank you.
And myself, Cam Rusland. So please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.